Thanks, Kathy. I'm been sober in the fearsome Steveston AA group in Richmond, British Columbia. I had my last drink of alcohol on February the 8th of 1976. And my name is Marty. I know. I was a prenatal alcoholic. A bunch of people in this room were not born in 1976. I don't care. You know, I used to look at the old timers and think, Jesus, if I looked like that, I wouldn't drink either. And now I am one of them. It's just horrible. Look like I've been sent out to be wrinkled. What am I supposed to do? Anyway, absolutely thrilled to be here. And yeah, got in late last night. Missed some really dear friends' talks. Mildred and Rick and some of the others. I heard somebody named Jonathan gave a hell of a talk, and if you put a blonde wig on him, he'd look exactly like Tammy's talk, and I don't know what the hell that means, but I'm pretty sure that I'm at an AA meeting. Anyway, it's like Tammy, of course. Tammy's, how many were at Tammy's talk this afternoon? It was an incredible talk. She was telling me how nervous she was before she started. I don't know why she would bother doing that. And that southern drawl, isn't that beautiful? You know what I love about southern women? They can insult you, but they do it in a way that you don't know you're being insulted, you know? Where did you get that ass? No, but anyway, whenever I hear a southern woman like that, I always think of the story of the southern belle that's in the airport at LaGuardia in New York, and because she's Southern, and because she's the belle, she goes over to this group, little clutch of women, and she says, "Hi, y'all. Where y'all from?" And one of these snotty women says to her, "Darling, we're from a place where we don't end sentences with prepositions." And she says, "I'm terribly sorry. Where are y'all from, bitch?" Yeah. Yeah. There was some confusion, by the way. I was in Washington, D.C. I have had this, and I'm going to tell you some about this, if you don't mind. I've had a kind of a dream experience since I've been sober, and I want to thank God publicly for that, because I forget sometimes when I'm on the firing line. But I had a chance to go to Washington and work on a project with children's cartoons, you know, for an immature alcoholic who's still watching Goofy. It was good. But they called me, and when they called me, it's like a year ago, they said they wanted me to talk Saturday night. Then they called back and said, "We don't want you Saturday night anymore." Well, I figured they must have heard one of my tapes or something. But anyway, some poltergeist or something got in there. Anyway, and so I'm happy to be here. Friday night's if you ever get a chance to talk at a convention, hope for Friday. Because Saturday morning, nobody remembers who the hell you were, and you've got the rest of the convention to enjoy. It's the best slot. Also, 20 or so years ago, I used to live down the road from here in a place called Hollywood. Yeah. And that's just a little north of Miami, 25 feet from the Rascal House. And I know. And anyway, when I was there was a guy that looked like he was the lead guitar player for Alabama at a meeting. I went to a lot of meetings. I was alone. I was away from my family. And I was, you know, in that place where I was teachable. Doesn't happen to me a lot. But I was there. And this guy got up that night and he talked about a God-shaped hole. And it was the first time I ever heard anybody put English onto what I felt all the time. Like gaping hole that, you know, you try and you put money in it and you put relationships in there and you prestige. Nothing fills it up except God. And that's why they call it a God-shaped hole. And that one meeting, that one speaker, that one night changed everything. It's like Bill Wilson, when he woke up in Charlestown Hospital, he said, nothing had changed, but everything was different. So don't tell me that, you know, we don't get it through our ears sometimes. It was just like the biggest aha, and the entire direction of my life shifted from that meeting on. Another thing that happened was they took me downtown Miami. I don't know what this place is, whether it's a rehabilitation place or a halfway house, but I'm telling you. You know, I don't know what ticket you paid to get your seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. These guys were like, man, you know, final stage down and outers. I really, you know, the entire front row had three teeth. I mean, they were just, oh. And I'm thinking, what am I going to say to these guys? You know what? What did I got drunk and sang too loud in the choir? I mean, what? What am I going to do? And then I relied on you know, what my mentors, my sponsors, my teachers said. They said, you know, you don't try and impress anybody. Just share your experience, share your strength, your hope. And so I told them that what I was like. I told them what happened, and I told them what I was like now. And at the end of it was like a roaring applause. Wow. And the woman that asked me to speak got up and she said, guys, what do you think? Do we want to give them the special gift? I thought, wow, special gift. Well, of course they should. And and so she delivered to me a little ring-sized gray velvet box. And she said, please don't open this until you're alone. And some place where you can really take in the full meaning of what happened here, the lives you touched, and thank you. And there's another big round of applause. Anyway, I got out in the car, and I got down the road a ways, and I pulled over. I couldn't stand it. I had to see what... I'm an alcoholic. And so I opened the box, and in that box, there was a white button with blue type on it, and it said, I saw Elvis. So that's why I'm not the Sunday morning speaker. But anyway, I love Orlando. Sunshine, and there's, you know, Universal and SeaWorld and Disney. And that ride in Disney, that Small World ride. Is that the closest ride there is to an alcoholic journey? I mean, you want to get on it, right? You're excited when you first get it, right? And then you think it's going to end because the music goes, and then you turn the corner, and it never ends. It never ends. And you're pleading with God, I need to work. I need to finish. I need to be with my family. I want off to ride. And then they change key. And then you turn another corner, and you're never coming out of there. Cut your wrist, cut your throat, but you're still in the boat. It's a big world after. Any Al-Anon that wants to understand the monotony of alcoholism needs to get on that ride. Your world gets smaller and smaller. You're drinking with the same people. You're telling the same joke in the same bar with the same idiots, and you fight with the same dummy, and the same cop busts you all the time. The guy that busted me the last time, Bill Siemens, tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, take your pick tonight. What would you like, drunk in a public place or indecent exposure? I look down, and I'm peeing. I didn't know. Oh, this is just in from Alcoholics Anonymous World Services. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous World Services, Inc., and alcoholics all over the world want this audience to understand that this speaker's view of the Magic Kingdom's attraction known as a small world is only his opinion and does not represent that of AA World Services, Inc. And that, in fact, we have a tradition that clearly states that we have no opinion on outside issues. Lest problems of property, money, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose with regard to the speaker's contravention of this tradition, AAA World Services, Inc., and Alcoholics Worldwide respectfully ask that you pray for him. And so that's... So, Friday night. I mean, Friday night, you should have a light speaker. God, you've got one. You know, it's an interesting thing. You hear this, I don't know how many meetings you go to, you hear what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now, right? Which, you know, they say, tell in a general way what it was like. But they don't say what it was like, they say what we were like. What were we like? What it is like is the result of how we were acting. If you don't believe me, think about the last time you got up in a really crappy mood and you went out, and how many idiots were there around you almost instantly. And when I'm in a really kind, generous mood, everything just kind of warms up. It's like I came across that place from the hotel to this room, and you were strangers, and you looked sophisticated, and I thought, why would you possibly be interested in hearing anything from me? And I felt different and apart. And then I heard Tammy speak, and she's done more jail time than me, and so I felt part of. And so I'm going to tell you a bit of what I was like. And usually at this juncture in my talk, I would launch into a hysterically funny account of my drinking. And it's dawned on me recently that it says in the book, and it's very specific in the book, it says that the problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And for all these years and at all these podiums, I've always talked about only the first half of the first step. And really, it's the unmanageability. It's the mind stuff that is so very important with us alcoholics. It's the thing. It's that strange mental blank spot that says, this time I'm going to drink and it's going to be different. How many experiments do you have to do before you realize you drink, you pee, you fight? What's going to be different? You know? In fact, the more you drink, the more you pee, the more you fight, the more you... You know what I'm saying? Only you can't remember it. God only wakes you up for the really humiliating pieces. If you got drunk and got lucky, you don't remember that. Put your friend through a bank window and you're clear. You know, you just wake up as he's going through. Anyway. So what is the mental attitude that precedes or is sort of required for somebody to become a real alcoholic? Real alcoholic, like the big book describes. Well, I can tell you this, that I can't ever remember a time of any manageability. I don't know about you. The only question I have with the steps when it says our lives became unmanageable, I don't remember ever having any control. I mean, I was just born out of control. The doctor slapped me. I was pissed. I'm telling you. I just know that. And so I remember as a kid, I had this weird perception, and it went like this. I hate you. How can I get you to love me? I hate you. Love me. Talk about unmanageable. How the hell do you manage that? And it wasn't that these people didn't have many reasons that they were making me hate them. Like my mother, she was breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. How much can you take of that before you're resentful? And, you know, some of you maybe went to schools where they rewarded creativity. Not where I went, man. By grade one, I was disillusioned. Grade two, I was getting the strap every day, sometimes twice a day. Grade three, the teacher actually tied me to the chair and beat me with a ruler. By grade four, they were talking about having me stay home every second day. Grade five, I got assaulted with a pointer. And grade six, it was Miller time. And nobody needed a drink more than... I mean, I could not. I used to sit at Christmas and think, what is going on here? I think this Santa thing is a lie. And my brother Michael, used to get up earlier than the rest of us, and he'd change all the presents that were toys to his name and the socks and the underwear to my name. I hated Santa. I hated him. My mother was breathing in and out, in and out, in and out. School, you know. I don't want you to think that that God is an unjust God. And I want you to know that my brother Michael was the nemesis of my existence through my early part of my life. He beat on me almost every day. When he was beating on me, he was calling me stupid and ugly. And I sponsored him into Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, yeah. He said, "Can you help me?" I said, "Yes, I can, son of a bitch. Come on in, and we'll..." Sorry. So, he's still sober. He shook off everything that he had in his body in my rec room, because I wanted to watch. And so, God's a very just God. I love my brother Michael today. I said, "Why did you do all that stuff, Mikey?" And he said, "Because I was so jealous of you. You got everything so easy." And I said, "Isn't that so funny? Because I was so jealous of you because you were so smart." And he said, "You know, the truth of the matter is, neither one of us are that bright." I said, "I know." And so, at 11 years old, I had a lot of issues. I had abandonment issues, and I had sex issues. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wanted some of that. And you hear people say, you know, "I didn't fit." I didn't know there was a fit. I mean, at 11 years old, I was thinking about jumping off the top of the house and killing myself. I remember it vividly. So many times I've had people say, "How could an 11-year-old possibly be alcoholic, you know?" I don't know. I just know that when I drank, I immediately had a thing happen. And it doesn't happen in most people. It happens in, like, you know, 4 out of 10. I mean, there's no real statistic on it, but the reality of it is that when I drank, something happened. It was sort of like if I ate a strawberry and I had no idea I was allergic to strawberries, I just broke out drunk. And it was instant. I didn't cross any line. If I'd have known there was a line, I would have been against it. But I didn't, nothing. I had the mental thing. I was like already in a place where I needed something to change something, or I wasn't going to be able to keep going. That's all you need. And you see, I was in grade 6. I was very confused, very alienated, angry, lonely, and I was hungry. And I just, you know, "I hate you. How do I get you to love me?" And I was playing in rock and roll bands because I have some musical ability, and they couldn't get any lead guitar players. So I, you know, a pair of diapers and a Fender guitar, you know. But I'm out there, and I'm in the bathroom with my buddy, and we get into the Loganberry wine. This is a gift straight from God. Loganberry wine goes down purple, comes up pink. There's nothing like it, and it floats sort of like Dream Whip on, you know. And I had that drink, and then it happened. You know, I don't want to bore you with what happened. It doesn't matter, other than the fact that for the first time in my life, I knew, A, I could beat my brother Michael up, which he needed. He was 16, I was 11. I hope you don't see a problem there. And I came home, and there was the first realization I had that there's only one alcoholic brain in the entire universe. And the reason I know this to be true is because no matter where you are on the globe, when somebody asks you how many drinks you've had, you will say, 2. And I did it that night. I came home, I'd fallen off my bike. Actually, I rode it into the back of a truck. My first vehicular accident. I did a skin donation for 30 or 40 yards and thought, "This does not even hurt. I love this stuff." You know, no knees in my pants, all skinned up, all blood. I get home. My mother says, were you drinking?" "Yes." "How many?" 2. "The last night I drank, the cop with the gun in my face, 'Were you drinking?" "Yes." 2. You know. That night, what happened was what happened to all of you. Emotionally, I was not cutting it. I didn't have friends. I had hostages. You know, if you were my friend and you had another friend, you were no longer my friend. But I couldn't stand hanging around with you. So I'd say, why don't you go hang around with him? Then you'd go do that. Then I'd feel betrayed. What's that, man? Go to Al-Anon? I'm sorry, what? And, I mean, I had two paper routes, and I owed $11. I mean, I was 11 years old. You know, like, what's wrong with that picture? Living beyond your means already. And then I drank this stuff, and suddenly, it's just like, I was okay. My mother, my Uncle Stan got it right away. My Uncle Stan was probably 50 years sober when he died. He got with an early, early guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he saw me drink at a wedding at age 11 or so. And he said, that boy's an alcoholic. And my mother said, oh, for heaven's sake, Stan, he's 11 years old. He said, trust me. Watch him bloom. And so the physical part, the I am powerless over alcohol part, and by the way, what other program starts off by having you admit something? All right? You know, you have to admit it. What does that mean? It means that I am delusional. I will not admit this. Right? How could it mean it? And I will admit that my life is unmanageable and that I don't know how to have friends, that I don't know how to go to work, that I don't know how to keep my word, that I don't know how to be honorable, that I can't ever build anything in my own eyes because I know what a total disaster as a human being I actually am. And so you're empty and hollow, and now you're ready for a drink. And you put that stuff in there, and all of a sudden you think to yourself, you know what? Screw it. Let's do it. Right? The new book. People say to me at 11 years old, where did you get liquor? Well, I was young. I wasn't stupid. Mom and Dad bought me a suit to go to a wedding. I'd put on my little suit. I'd go downtown. There's a lot of Ukrainians in our area that were having weddings every weekend. I'd just go in. They'd say, are you with the bride's party or the... I wasn't sophisticated. I said, both. They said, very unusual. Give you a home brew. And I'd drink that down, and then I'd lay on the floor and watch the band spin, you know, and I'm... My mother talked one time about me being about 12 years old, and she said I was gone all night. She was out of her mind, worried, and she said the sun came up, and just above the blades of grass, she saw a nose. So she knew I was okay, but I was out there unconscious. So it's a state of mind and body. But it says that our main problem centers in our mind. And this whole idea of not wanting to admit the delusion that somehow, some way, I'm going to, and this is so ridiculous, control and enjoy my drinking. I can't stand people that control. The minute you control drinking, it's not drinking anymore. It's boring. You know, you watch them there and they're drink it! Change! Change! Drink it faster, become loose. Please drink. I don't want to control my drink. I want to drink it and let it buck. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know who I'm going to be with. I never went to bed with an ugly woman, but I woke up with a few. You know that joke. So, and women with men, believe me. And so it centers in the mind. I couldn't get that. And you know, when you're a kid and you're drinking and it's progressing the way it was progressing, I mean, I'm in school, I'm in trouble in every area of my life. Of course I am. You can't stand authority because you don't respect authority. You can't stand fellowship because you don't understand it. And when people would say they love me, what I heard them say was, I want you to do something. Listen to me, if you don't trust, it's because you're not trustworthy. If you're not loved, it's because you're not loving. It's just that simple. Gandhi said, be what you want. That's been my experience. And I mean, at this stage in my life, I have none of these skills. You know, Winston Churchill once said, history's one damn thing after the other. Which made me doubt he was ever alcoholic, because for us, history is one damn thing over and over and over and over. And that pretty much describes age 11 to age 23 when I quit drinking. Over and over and over and So that's what I was like. I'm going to just share the last drinking experience I had, and that's all I want to talk about drinking, because that is not what's my problem. That was the solution to what's wrong with a lonely guy like me. That's what's the solution to a person that has the deep defects from which I suffer. And the problem is that the solution became a problem. And when the thing that's healing you starts to kill you, you really are in a bad place. And most of us don't get that. You know, think about this. Even if we're only six out of 100 are alcoholic. In this city, what is there, a million people here? There should be 60,000 people in this room at least. That's how many are running around there, out there untreated and in denial and not ready to admit anything. And so my last drinking episode started, like most of my drinking episodes, with the intention not to drink. I went out not to drink. I had made a deal the night before with God. I said to God, if you could just somehow get me out of this little jam I'm in, I will never drink ever again. Not that I related my problems to drinking. I just thought that's something I could give up and then maybe become a missionary. But miraculously, as happens with alcoholics, things started to resolve. And by 5 o'clock, everything was resolved and I was out of trouble. And I thought to myself, man, what a day. This has been a lot of stress. And then Tammy was talking about the keen mind of the alcoholic. There's something you'll never hear at an Al-Anon meeting, I'll tell you. I'm tired. I've had a really bad day. I'm 23 years old. I've got a 6-month-old baby. I've got a wife. I don't even understand how she got pregnant. I honestly don't understand. I mean, when we had that baby, at one point we had one bag of puff wheat in the house, and I told her, if you phone your mother and father, I absolutely will kill you, and kill the baby. And then I will kill me, because nobody's going to find out how bad this is. Pride and anger keep you blind better than anything else I know. So if there's something you're defending, you already know something's wrong. And so we suffered through that, and I had a little reprieve in my alcoholism. You know, this is why we know it's a disease, is because it has symptoms. And I went into just a little remission. And I had like 2 or 3 months where I'd have a beer and I'd think, you know, all right. Just like acne, I guess, it's gone. That whole problem's gone. I can go and have a beer after work with the guys and then go home. And it was good. And we got a little house and we got some money and things were a lot better. And then, of course, you know what happens. One day it just starts again. And this day that the trouble ended and I was thinking, you know, did I say to God I would never drink again? Or did I say to God I would never drink again to excess? Because I would never say to God that I would never drink again, because Jesus turned water into wine in Capernaum, which was his first miracle, which means that Jesus Christ wants us to drink. So no matter how you look at this, God wants me to drink, but just not whiskey or something. And so I went across for a beer, and the worst thing happened that can happen to an alcoholic. I only wish that it was true that, like they say, if you drink, you'll die. I wish. It doesn't work like that. You'll die. It goes, you know what I'm saying? So I take a drink, nothing happens. I figure, what? I'll have another one. I have another one, nothing happens. I have another one, and I think to myself, who's going to stop me from having another one? See, when you're sober on willpower, will says I won't, and will says I will. And it just depends what part of your will is winning on what day. That's why we can't get sober on our own power. Because we've invested ourselves in the hands of an idiot. Which is why when I first read the second step, I thought it said a power stranger than yourself. So I went across, and when I came to the first time, I had put my friend Jim's head through a drywall about the sixth time. And his eyes were kind of rolling. I used to put Jim's head through drywall. I have no idea why. It just seemed I needed to do that. And the funniest thing about Jim was when I quit, he said, you don't have a problem. You know. Then we went to the Labatt's Brewery. And they said we could have all we wanted to drink. The place was empty. And by, 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, they came in. They remembered that, in fact, another party was coming in and we'd have to leave. Because we were smashing that place to pieces, fighting and throwing each other around. And then we went to a Chinese food place. I remember I broke all the back of my teeth off, demonstrating to the other alcoholics that Chinese food is cooked to a place where all bones can be digested. And you know, what is it with alcoholics? We'll lie when the truth is good enough. I had an uncle that was a Canadian war veteran and a hero in the infantry. And when he was drunk, he would always talk about his adventures in the Navy. I don't understand that. But, and so, we get thrown out, and then we head for where else? The best hotel in the city. Right, because I've got blood coming down my mouth, look like Count Dracula. The guys are hammered, and we start throwing each other around, and then we get in the elevator, and there's a little guy in the elevator, so we start tossing him around a little bit, and the doors open, and I swear to God, God is my witness, his feet did not touch the floor, but he left the elevator. We were all kind of like, wow. And then we went up to the top of the inn, and they had a band there. And then I remembered, but wait a minute. I'm a musician. So after we were asked to leave there, we started pushing each other in the elevator and pushing each other. And we got downstairs, and I pushed Jim, and Jim pushed me, and I went into a parking meter. I don't care how drunk you are. February the 7th in Canada, it's like 170 below. Indoors. You spit, and it goes, bing, 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 bing. It's cold, and cool, like that. And I got mad, and I picked little Jimmy up, and I hucked him, and he went through the Royal Bank window. I can still remember him going, yeah. And that's when I turned around, and I saw the gun. A cop had come out of the alley, and he had a gun in my face. And I said, relax, we're just drunk. I thought that about everything. I thought that about taking your car and smashing it up, and I thought that about breaking your heart, and I thought that about not keeping my promises, and I thought that about my own failure as a human being. I'm just drunk. What a handy thing that is. And I mean, people do that. Oh, I'm an alcoholic. Well, you know what? Grow up. That's why you have groups. G-R-O-U-P. Grow up. So, this cop suddenly says, wait a minute. Are you that guy on the radio, that Marty Jeffrey guy? And I said, yes, I am. And that's the weatherman right in there. And he said, you are the funniest person on earth. And I said, then could you put your gun down? Because I'm going to mess myself pretty soon if you don't put that. And several hours later, there was like plywood in the window, and the bank manager knew it. We got off. And what happens with alcoholics? How do we get away with it until it's so serious that we're dying? And we went from there to my car, and I decided that there's no way I was going to pay parquet charges. Well, we're going over the top. Do you know why those big cement things on the edge of those parking lots? They don't launch your car into the air. They stop your car. And Jimmy went forward and he broke his nose and right across, and I said, you know, we might as well call my wife because I think we're going to call her a night. And I woke up in the morning and there they were, the four horsemen. You know, the terror, the bewilderment, the, oh my God, the bits and pieces of the evening, and that, oh man, I just got out of trouble at work, and oh my God, and there she is, and she, that doesn't look good. She's not happy. And you know how you start casing the joint? If you're out of town, you call the front desk and say, trace this call and tell me where I am. You know, it's like you... And she was mad. I found out later that she was actually packing to leave. I didn't think that was possible, a stud like myself, but it happened. It happened. The phone was ringing, and it was my sister. My sister Lori, the only non-alcoholic of all my siblings. My brother Paul turned out to be not only alcoholic, but he is using cocaine. And when I was sober about 25 years, I sent him a bumper sticker that said, my other car is up my nose. And he said some very unkind things and accused me of being a self-righteous AA. And I won't say the words because it's not pretty. And then he proceeded to get straight and sober. Thank you, Jesus. It was wonderful. So my sister said, how are you? Where do they get this stuff, you know? It's the crack of noon. Why are you calling so early, first of all? I want to vomit, but I can't because I haven't got... If I throw anything else up, it's going to have hair on it. I mean, I just am so sick. And you got the bits and pieces, you know, the memory of the night before. Oh, man, I haven't got time to talk to her. And she says something that just, I don't know whether she went to your Al-Anon meeting or what happened, but she says to me, quote, do you think you might have a drinking problem? I think, what? I drink better than anybody. No, I don't have a drinking problem. She said, would you please talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? I thought, oh, man, I haven't got enough trouble. Now I've got to help some guy from Alcoholics. Oh, all right, I'll do it, but Lord, will you just find some other servants? And that's what I was like. You know, thinking about yourself. You know, being self-centered is not thinking about yourself all the time. But it's thinking that everything is, you know, and we do this in sobriety. Everything's about me. I can in sobriety get up and you say hi to me and I think, oh God, you know, I can't wave to another person. I'm exhausted. Or you can walk by me and I go, hey, you know, see if I wave to you next time. It's just so self-centered. What I find out then is that your pet passed away and you're in a bad place and I'm really sorry for my behavior. But this is when you're alcoholic, it's in the extreme, isn't it? It's like Earth people's problems on steroids or something. You know, your head gets bigger. That's an outside issue, and I don't want another note. But my word is my bond. I won't go there. So I meet her little friend from Alcoholics Anonymous, who turns out not to be little. And this is what happened. She had a friend named Mardell who had an alcoholic husband who had recovered in the penitentiary under a guard named Dwayne. The guard explained to me that when he worked for the railroad, he learned how to steal, and when he worked at the penitentiary, he learned how to lie. And then he started to drink, and he learned how to lie and steal and hurt people. So he had my undivided attention, just almost immediately. He was over 6 feet, probably four, in any direction. He had a brush cut and he was Norwegian. I hated Norwegians because my father-in-law was Norwegian. And when I would bring my poor little wife home when we were dating, he would be outside at 6 o'clock in the morning waiting for us. And as I walked by him, he'd go, Yeah, translate that. So, and he was proud of being Norwegian. He had a brush cut. I'm a, at this point in time, and I'm not any longer, a radio announcer, drive time. And I thought I was pretty slick. And he was, he had a brush cut and he drove a Ford Egg Blue LTD. Do you remember those cars? They didn't park, they docked. I mean, they had drag. Cars could get behind them and shut the engine off. They'd just get pulled along behind them. No. Ford had a better idea. That's what he was driving, and he didn't have any, it had vinyl seats and no carpet, you know, just oh man, it was rough. And I get in the car, and he's a comedian. This is what you need when you're dying, and you're wondering what she's up to, and if work's going to find out about the bank window. And I wonder if Jim got stitches, and all of that stuff's going through your head, bits and pieces, bits and pieces, bits and pieces. And he says, would you like to go to the A&W and have a coffee? A coffee? Why? Well, because I want to share with you some of my story. Oh, good. Okay. Coffee. And we didn't even have to leave the car. They brought it right to the door. So we're in there, and he's telling me these god-awful stories about his drunkenness. What happened was, I got conned by an alcoholic, recovered 13 years sober, gorilla. And the more he talked, the more I knew I'd done worse. And the more he talked, the more my need became to tell him how much worse I was than he was. Because you're an alcoholic like I am. You could go under a snake wearing a top hat. And you want to share that with people. You know, you feel it makes you bigger. Oh, yeah, I rolled the car. I did, you know, gunshots. Yeah, I've done all that. And so when I finished, I'd probably done about 60% of my fifth step with this idiot. And you can't get it back. So I thought, oh, why would I tell him that? The keen alcoholic mind had let me down that time. And he said something that, to this day, is the most profound thing anyone has ever said to me. He said, well, books suggest we don't pronounce another person alcoholic. Something that you're going to have to find out for yourself. But he said, don't you think that if you didn't drink, you'd get in less trouble? I was screwed. It was just the truth. I mean, there was nothing to say to that. If he'd have said I was an alcoholic, I would have given him a whole number of reasons why I wasn't alcoholic. But he didn't do that. And he said, I'll pick you up for a meeting tomorrow morning. I said, oh, well, okay, more coffee? And yeah, lots of coffee. And he said, I'll pick you up at 9. We're going to the breakfast group. It's breakfast? Breakfast? You know. Let me tell you, your first miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous is swallowing an egg in the morning. Breakfast group? Okay. Looking forward to it. Thinking I'll never see you again, you big Norwegian pig. I hated him, but I somehow wanted him to like me. That hadn't stopped. So, anyway, I left the house at 8 o'clock because he was going to be there at 9, and then it happened. He was waiting outside in the car. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, oh, I thought you might get mixed up, so I got here a little early. We went to a meeting and there was, you know, like I'm 23 years old. There was people at this meeting that had died and they just hadn't taken them out yet. Oh! 40, 50-year-old people. Oh, ugly, wrinkly people going up and down some stairs or steps or some damn thing. I didn't know what they were talking about. One of them was stuck on the fifth stair. And one of the other ones said, if you don't get off that fifth stair, you're going to get drunk. And I thought, let's go get that fifth stair right now. Because I really don't want to eat these eggs, you know? And you're kind of looking around for all the other losers you can talk about these guys with after the meeting, you know? And the guy at the front who was 170, he had been sent out to be wrinkled. You have no idea how old this guy was. Is reading out of something they called a big book, which was not that big. They're drinking coffee like they've got colostomies. Nobody could drink that much coffee. Then I knew where, you know, there was a guy named Bill and a guy named Bob. More coffee? Nay, Bob. You know, it's like, nay, Bob. So, by the way, look at that happy face. Do you think he's blessing me right now? I don't think so. And I always used to start my talk off by saying, do you think it a coincidence that a proctologist was the type of doctor God selected to help us? A man that specializes in broken arseholes, do you honestly think it's a coincidence? So, this guy at the front of the room says, I couldn't believe it. I was gobsmacked. I was speechless. He said, if you want what we have. What would that be? You're addicted to coffee. You have no life. You're eating eggs in the morning. Somebody should just take you out back and put you to sleep, you poor things. And he said, you know, and then he threatened me. He said, if you don't want what we have, there's only two choices. To stagger on to an alcoholic death. Or to join us on the road to recovery. I thought, I'll take death. I would be happy to take death. I can't do this. I can't do this. And I look at the guy and I'm with, oh my God. This is the worst drinking episode ever and I wasn't drinking. Oh, my God, please wake me up. Please wake me up. Oh, man. We get out in the parking lot. Dwayne says, how'd you like the meeting? I said, I loved it. That is interesting stuff. You guys are right at the heart of that disorder. If there's anything I can do for you, like raising money, you want to come on my radio show, promote Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, shut up. He said, I'll come get you for a meeting tonight. I said, no, I don't want to go to any more meetings. He said, you don't understand. I didn't ask you. I'm telling you, you're going to another meeting tonight. I said, I have rights. He said, no, you don't. I have rights. He said, no, you don't. You're an alcoholic. I said, you said you couldn't. He said, that was yesterday. Today, I'm sure you're an alcoholic. Let me tell you something, because I hear this all the time. If he doesn't want it, I didn't want it. I didn't even know what you had, never mind wanting what you had. I thought somebody should try and help you with what you had, never mind that I wanted what you had. I didn't want it. I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want it for 90 days. I didn't want to get sober. That baboon came to my back door that night, had a coffee cup the size of a 10-gallon hat. He's winking knowingly at my Norwegian wife. And I thought, oh, there he, that's what this is about. Her and him. You know, I was hoping he'd take her as long as I didn't have to go to any more of those meetings. But we went to the meeting, and it was a better meeting. There was a couple of girls. Hookers, I figured. I mean, who else would be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but hookers? And you know that thing they do to try and make you feel welcome when you're new? Has the newcomer got anything you'd like to ask? I said, oh yeah, I got a question. I'd been kicked out of Kinsman, JC's, school. My radio job, they didn't ever fire me. They just said, your last few days here have been your last few days here. You know what I'm saying? And so getting kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous seemed to me a cakewalk. So I said, I got a question. Are you two girls hookers? And Ruth looked at me and she said, oh, I was never a hooker, but sometimes I'd get really drunk and I'd pick up an anemic little turd like you. That's what they did. They laughed. The whole thing, they laughed. And I felt very centered out and angry. And we got outside and I said, I am not going to another meeting. He said, oh, yeah, you're too funny. You got to stick around. We're really enjoying you. I said, I don't have to. He said, you do have to. He said, Marty, do you understand the name of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, not really. And he said, anonymous means that you don't know who we are. And we're everywhere. And we're watching you. I said, that's not legal. He said, I know. I said, I'll go to the police. He said, half of them are in the fellowship. I said, what do I have to do? He said, I'll tell you this. You drink, and I will know. And when I find you're drinking, I will come over and I will bust every bone in your body. I said, why? He said, because if you drink, you're going to get hurt, and I don't want you hurt by strangers. I, out of love for you, will hurt you myself. I had never had this kind of love and attention. This kind of alcoholic embrace somehow. This fellowship of the Spirit. I would have died if he would have said, oh, wait for him. He'll. No, I would not have come. When he was 40 years sober, I spoke at his extravaganza, and I went on and on and on about the sacrifice he'd made and how he, you know, was with me the first 90 days, and he was at my house all the time, and he got up and he said, what a load of crap. He said, I didn't care about him. He said, Audrey and I were fighting. I didn't want to go home. That's all. My mom was wrong. I'm not special. And so, I suffered 90 days, 90 meetings, probably closer to 120 meetings. And I heard a little man named Wesley Parrish. You remember Wesley Parrish? Who's from West Palm Beach? Wasn't he? He's from Pompano Beach, right? Yeah. Pompano. Thank you. Got a light? So anyway, it's not easy to get a heckler at AA, but you get them. Wesley was about 4 foot square, and he gave an incredible talk. He ended with that poem, the auctioneer, you know. The auctioneer didn't know if it was even worthwhile to sell that old violin, but he held it up with a smile, and he said, good evening, friends. Who'll start the bidding for me? And somebody said, $1, and he said, $1, and who'll make it two? $2, who'll make it three? $3, $3 once, twice, going, and no. A gray-haired man from the back of the room came and picked up the bow, and he dusted off that old violin, and he lovingly tightened the strings, and the music he played was like the sound that's made when a chorus of angels might sing. Well, when he was done, the auctioneer, but now in a voice soft and low, said, now what am I offered for this violin? And he held it up with the bow, and somebody said, $1,000. $1,000, said he, and who make that two? $2,000. $2,000, $2,000, who make it three? $3,000. $3,000 once, twice, going and gone, said he. Well, some in the crowd laughed out loud, but others could not quite understand. What changed the value? And quick came the reply. It was the touch of the master's hand. Well, many a man with his life out of tune, battered and scarred by sin, has been auctioned for cheap by a thoughtless crowd. Just like that violin, a mess of pottage, bottle of wine. He stumbles on and on. He's going once, going twice, going and almost gone when the master appears. And we still don't understand. the good that's been got of the soul that's been wrought with just the touch of a master's hand. Wesley said that poem that night. I remember the crowd coming to their feet. It was gratitude night. I had a lot of gratitude because it was the 90th day and I knew I was done with Dwayne. I knew that with just a modicum of alcohol in me, I could kill him. I could set that Ford LTD on fire. And most of all, kill his dog, which was really old and couldn't bark anymore. It was so old, you'd come to the door and the dog would go, which, of course, would get the drunks rolling on the floor, but I didn't think it was funny. This is Saturday night with Tinker. Anyway, Wesley finished. The crowd came forward to thank him. I got out the back door, and by the time I got to the parking lot, Wesley was beside me. And he said, "What is bothering you, boy?" And I said, "You are. You and all like you. I've had enough of this crap." He said, "Let me tell you something about yourself." He said, "You have within you a great thing you need to deliver, but you're too scared to even do it. You sound bad when you swear. Some people swear good, you don't." And then he started to tell me stuff that I was sure Dwayne must have told him. Then he started telling me stuff that Dwayne didn't know. I thought, she's been talking to him. Then he started telling me stuff she didn't know. And I went, wow. This Alcoholics Anonymous is really something. And I saw it, and I wanted what he had. I wanted it. That's right, he had a motorhome and a big diamond ring. I wanted. He blew me away. He was so there, you know. He was just right in your soul. And I said, "Wesley, I think I'm not going to drink anymore." He said, you are never going to drink ever again, boy. Because you got it. Whatever it is, you got it. I saw it when I saw you. And I got in the car and I told my wife, "I think I'm done drinking." And she said, "What are you talking about? Of course you are. And Dwayne said if you drank that he would kill you. So, yeah, you've been done a long time." 31 years ago, it's a dusty story. I've told it many, many times. That's what happened. And you know, we went through a series of steps. I had to come to understand that there was something that was different, that somehow I'd never accessed before, that just in behind this huge ego of mine, there was a connection or something, that deep within every man, woman, and child, there's the basic idea of God, and that I needed to not go outside, I needed to get back inside and reconnect with this thing. And so I came to believe that there was a power greater than anything I had ever known. The Lakota Indians call it the great mystery. A power that if I would turn the things that I was doing and my life, my will, the things that I wanted to do over to this power, and if I would just get rid of all of the things in the inventory that were about it, it's not about understanding your step four. God, if you're doing that, you'll never get any recovery. If you think you're going to write it and find out, "Oh, I know now why I did that." You know. It's a small room. That can go on forever, too. It's just like an inventory. 14 rotten tomatoes, 2 bad cucumbers. This is the reality of it. This is what I want to get rid of. This is what I want to keep. That's all it's about. And so they made an appointment for a fifth step, and then they handed me a piece of paper and said, "Write down your resentments and try and finish before Christ comes home, okay?" And I started out and I started, "Dwayne." "Wesley." "Tinker." "My wife, my life, my radio station. My God, is there anything I don't resent?" I said to Dwayne, "Can we just write down something I like? That would be so much shorter." He said, "You've got to do these things because we want to know what the basic flaw has been inside of you. You know, is it anger? Is it jealousy? Is it greed? Sloth? Envy? Gluttony?" So we did all that stuff. And then I was squarely at where I humbly asked God, "See, there's a problem. When you've got the first step, you have to admit something, and then later on they're asking you to humbly do something. You have better done something in between." Humbly Another word for humble is meek. My ego doesn't like meek. My ego doesn't like humble. My ego thinks that if I admit I'm wrong, that I die. I disappear. It's not okay for me to be. I have to be right. I have to justify. When it starts. I have a constantly chattering group of idiots up there. And when I start writing these things down, the idiots are saying, you don't want to share that with anybody, buddy. Why, if they know that, you could go to jail. And Dwayne said, you know what? If you don't do it, you're going to drink. And if you drink, you die. And not quick, stupid. Just do it. And I did it. And I went to a priest, and I'm slick. So I said to the priest, before we get started, would you mind if I asked you an ecumenical question? He said, oh, God, yeah, okay. I said, do you think the Garden of Eden was mythical or actual? And he said, do you think I'm an idiot? Do you think I'm so inexperienced that I'd let you take me down that bunny hole, you little idiot? Where is your list? What's your name, Father Bob? Father. Yeah. Humbly. Meek, the meek shall inherit the earth. Humbly asked. That's not demanded. There's a big, 12:12 says, big difference between a request and a demand. And humbly I said to God, I now know I am these things and I no longer want this. Take it from me. And he said, I will. When I wanna. Right now you're so obnoxious, you're funny. So I'm going to leave it like that for a while, okay? And I made a list of the people that I was harmed. Some of them I was glad about it. But I eventually became, here's a list of people that I've harmed. And I've got to make a list. I'm willing to make amends to these ones now. I'll make amends to these ones when I get through the first ones. And then here's some that I really need some help with, Father. I don't know how I'm going to go to them and say these things. It was incredible. I just did my last amend. I'm 31 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and last year I got to do the last amend on that list, and it was a girl. I didn't know where she went. I never heard of her again, but I hurt her deeply when we were kids. And my brother Paul phoned, the guy, and he said, you'll never guess who's in my office, right? It was this girl. I said, oh my God, I want to talk to her so bad. And he put her on the phone, and I said, I need to say something to you. Can I have your telephone number? And I phoned her, And I said, I was in your life for 15 minutes 100 years ago, and here are the things I said to you, and here's where it was coming from, and it was me I hated, not you. You were a beautiful person. If any of that stayed in your mind, or if there, blah, 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 blah. And she said, geez, I never think of those things when I think of you, and I do think of you. I always think of all the fun we had. Immediately remorseful for making the call. Could have got by without doing that one. So, if this stuff's hanging you up, just do it. You think you're going to do it perfect? Get out of here. What did we ever do perfect? I couldn't even stay perfectly drunk. Just do it. You're going to hear brilliant speakers here this weekend, right after this. And you're going to, which could happen. And you're going to get insights, and you're going to have ahas, and you're going to get, your spirit's going to say to you, let's move now. And then your ego's going to say, you better not. And here's the thing that you can say to your ego right away. Shut up. We listen to you. Now we're in the program. We're not doing this stuff anymore. And so I go down to that place, that connection, that great mystery, and I say to God, take from me the things that stand in the way of my being of maximum service to you. Do with me as you will. Build whatever you want to build. Just relieve me of the burden, and believe me, it's been a burden of self. It's not thinking less of myself, it's thinking of myself less. And so I became conscious. And I'd love to tell you at 31 years sober that I am a miracle child, because I'm about to tell you what I am like. And I'll be very, very brief, because I know I'm running 3 hours long. I'll tell you what I'm like now. I am ready to stand up for what I've done. This is probably the biggest thing I am to now. I mean, when I do something wrong, I can own it. You know, I get in the car and there's people that annoy me and I flip out and immediately I'm behind myself saying, Marty, grow up. I read things and I'm touched. I had a 32-year marriage that ended. I didn't want it to end. It just ended. I had this incredible woman. She just could never get over. She never got over all the stuff I did to her when I was a kid. She stopped going to Al-Anon and she became more perfect. I became more flawed. And I'd love to tell all you alcoholics, encourage the Al-Anons around you. It's a great program. It really is. I really believe that was the thing that ended my marriage. I really do. And so, we were the best of friends. She just likes going to Africa and going on safaris, and it took me 6,000 years to evolve out of there. I don't want to go back. And we're just different people. And we had three kids. I got a 32-year-old son. I've got a 30-year-old son. I got a 20-year-old daughter, and I got two grandchildren. Farah, every time she sees me, she goes, "Oh, man." And are you ready? Hang on to your underwear. I have a 10-month-old son. Now, I met this beautiful young woman. She got drunk. Even when you're not drinking it can still get you. That's it. His name is Luca. And what I'm like now is that every day, I haven't worked for a year. I just took the entire year off to watch him go through his first year of life. Because at podiums all over the world, I kept saying, "I wish I had a baby. I wish I had a child that I could be a real father to." Well, God said, "Okay. Are you nuts? I'm too old. I can't stay up all night." The other day, he golden, you know, like this, and you know what I'm talking about? The other night in Vancouver, they have the international fireworks, and Luca was in his bugaboo there snoozing, and the first went off, and he went. And I saw his little eyes, and he was searching, and then he saw me. He put his little arms out, and I grabbed him, and I held him on my knee, and his little jaw went. And we watched the fireworks, and I thought, let me die right now. Oh, my God. This is what I've always wanted. A partnership with another human being. And so, I've been all over the world. I've talked all over the world. I made a lot of money. I've had a wonderful life, and there's only one reason. It's because I put the plug in the jug, and I keep going to those stupid meetings. If there's anything in my talk tonight that offended any of you, please take it home and use it. Good night.